Symbols do matter, especially if this fence on the back roads could talk. It has a personality. Woven chain link fences have twists, tie wires, knuckles, clamps, flanges, bands and sleeves on the fence. Fence vernacular, yes. No, it is more cultural with this one. The is the most frequently used word in the English language. It is a definite article by role and highlights a noun. In this case, single quotation marks are used around the word, the, as this fence is significant, not common. It is repeated throughout. Also, on the top rail of a security fence like the fence, you can see the barbed wire arm bases and arms. It's a casting used in combination with one or two barbed wire extension arms held securely in place. The strands of barbed wire usually run horizontally. It did so. It remains a tall, rigid fence. You can tell it is weathered by time. You could never jump this barrier because there was an intention. If the fence represents children, it has a stoic type of personality. This stoic fence remains calm and composed, even in the face of pain or difficulty, and does not readily show its emotions. The barbed wire has been removed, but the vertical posts that held the strands beyond the top rail remain, turned inward, purposely. Not to keep people out, but in. It was an enclosure. Children still play here under different circumstances. It is now a schoolyard of acceptance that is evolving like Canadian society. This fence remains as a symbolic reminder of not only the residential school on Moose Factory Island but the original deceit by the government in their dealings with First Peoples in this area, which represents the norm of pan-Canadian Indigenous relations. And we will learn about this from two researchers who tried to make a difference back then. This emotional story, like the fence, has twists and turns, but the fence's weaving is with Indigenous and non-Native people, and what transpired. Horden Residential School. Horden Hall was one of these and was surrounded by the fence. It had many different names over the course of its operation. Residential schools were government-sponsored religious schools that were established to assimilate Indigenous children into Euro-Canadian culture. The system was in place between 1879 and 1997. Bishop Horden Hall, also known as the Moose Factory Indian Residential School, was an Anglican-run residential school that operated from 1906 to 1976 on Moose Factory Island. There was an iteration of buildings. It was initially established as a mission and boarding school in the 1850s, with the bishop's residence being converted into a school in 1905. The school faced a fire in 1914, leading to the construction of a new building, which was later named Bishop Horden Hall in 1953. The school transitioned into a hostel in the 1960s and was ultimately closed in 1976 and then eventually torn down. The known students who died there are found here. It is thought others could be buried in the school yard or in the nearby cemetery because of the following. In 1950, the Moose Factory Indian and Inuit Hospital was constructed as a tuberculosis facility. In the early days of residential schools, Indigenous children were sometimes sent to hospitals when they fell ill, called Indian TB. Residential schools were created by Christian churches and the Canadian government as an attempt to both educate and convert Indigenous youth and to assimilate them into Canadian society. The school was named after John Horden, 1828-1893, the first Anglican bishop of Moosewani. He dedicated over 40 years to missionary work in northern Canada, becoming fluent in Cree, Ojibwe, and Inuktitut. He translated Christian writings, including the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer, into Cree syllabics. The schools disrupted lives and communities, causing long-term problems among Indigenous peoples. Former students demanded recognition and restitution, resulting in the Indian residential schools. There was a settlement agreement in 2006 and a formal public apology by Prime Minister Stephen Harper in 2008. In total, an estimated 150,000 First Nation, Inuit, and Métis children attended residential schools. There were approximately 86,000 Indigenous peoples in Canada who at some point were enrolled as children in the Canadian Indian residential school system. It recognized the damage inflicted by the residential schools and established a $1.9 billion compensation. It is not about the money, but the harm done, and the fence remains as a reminder. Fenced in. I wondered about the fence's memories. I went looking for Elisa Schurman, who did her master's in anthropology at Horden Hall. Her 1994 McMaster University thesis was entitled, Fenced In, Horden Hall Residential School at Moose Factory. If you want to understand more, read the memories. She interviewed more than 25 survivors. 17 of these individuals attended Horden Hall in the 1960s, and the other 8 attended its precursor, Bishop Horden Memorial, from the 30s through the 50s. All self-identified as survivors. In her abstract, she says, memories of residential school experiences reveal themes of the emotional significance of the first day, loneliness, routines, metaphors of involuntary institutionalization, separation into peer groups, resistance, gangs, punishment and abuse. Individuals had a range of negative and positive experiences in Horden Hall. The effects of residential school experiences on the individual, family of origin and community are explored. Individuals commonly experienced ambivalence over native identity, difficulty opening up emotionally and difficulty re-establishing close ties with their families of origin. The community of Moose Factory currently reflects the pattern of peer group interactions from Horden Hall in the area of socializing. In her foreword, she stated, I went to residential school in India. I remember feeling lonely, cut off from a sense of family, dependent on peers and terrible homesickness. I felt that the experience of attending a boarding school in a different culture might give me some personal insight into the experiences of native individuals in religious boarding institutions. I was greatly humbled by listening to these individuals' experiences. Not only were they in an institution based on foreign values, but their autonomy as individuals and their culture were not respected. One poignant interview. The individual said, "It's too late now to fix what was done. It's what you call irreparable damage. We can't forget the past. You can't remove part of our brain and take away that emotion. They can't take away any part of us. It's how we have to live for the rest of our lives with what we've learned, what we've experienced, no matter how many people do interviews with us." I needed to talk to Lisa about how she felt more than 30 years later. I thought I had finally found her. But in an email exchange with a legal firm, looking for Lisa, she works, ed, at KMLAW, she did a McMaster U research paper. Trying to locate her? Forwarded message, from, Backroads Bill. Good afternoon, Mr. Steer. Lisa Schurman was employed at Kosky Minsky LLP. Unfortunately, she passed away in 2022. She was ahead of her time and had identified the effects of the fence. John Long. Who was John Long? He was a leader, and he knew of the fence firsthand. He was a non-native who knew the Cree on the James Bay coast. He passed away on March 2, 2016. After achieving a master's and doctorate at the University of Toronto, he moved to Moose Factory, where he taught and served as a principal in the community's public schools and as an educational advisor with the Mushkegawuk Council. He eventually became a Nipissing University faculty member within the Faculty of Education in 2000. In 2010, he published his groundbreaking book Treaty No. 9. Making the agreement to share the land in far northern Ontario in 1905. His book exposes how the government omitted and misrepresented central elements of the treaty in its conversations with the Mushkegawuk people. From an activehistory.ca review of the book in 2016, the website article says about Professor Long's book, "It sets the record straight while illuminating the machinations and deceit behind treaty making." In an Associated Review, historian J.R. Miller writes, "Dr. Long has done the First Nations of far northern Ontario an enormous service and shows scholars of native newcomer relations how ethnohistory should be done." Long's research inspired award-winning filmmaker Alanis Obomsawin's documentary, Trick or Treaty. This 2014 documentary is so worth viewing. The overview states, the Canadian government, the original treaty represents a surrendering of Indigenous sovereignty, while the descendants of the Cree signatories contend its original purpose to share the land and its resources has been misunderstood and not upheld. Professor Long's lengthy relationship with and deep commitment to the Mushkigawuk people are part of the book's success. From the review, in remembering her colleague and friend, Dr. Katrina Srigley explains, John, in his commitment to fatherhood and friendship, and in his deeply ethical work as a teacher and researcher, gifted us important lessons about reconciliation and respectful relationships. In a 2013 interview, Professor Long summarized the goal of his research by saying, "What I'd like to see is treaty implementation." Foreshadowing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he added that, "I'd love to see federal and provincial governments working with Aboriginal communities to actually implement the treaties in ways that support people's views of self-reliance, education, housing and infrastructure, but really for their vision of their future in Canada." For him, public education was critical, and he was central to society's efforts to invite people to hear what Aboriginal leaders were saying. Dr. Long said, "We have this important role to help people become aware of the issues." First testimonials. Fran Cucci knows of and respects the work of John Long. She resides on Nipissing First Nation with her partner and, although retired, continues to be involved in the field of Indigenous education. Upon contact, she said, her interests include gardening, beekeeping and kayaking, almost anything to be outside. I like that. Fran says she has been very fortunate over the years to work with and learn from many very knowledgeable and committed Indigenous educators. Although John was not Indigenous himself, I certainly include him as a mentor and colleague in this work we do. This is not a eulogy but a testimonial to John Long's work. Long before I met John Long, I had heard about the impressive work he was doing as an educator in Moose Factory. Today, we might refer to it as culturally relevant and inclusive. Not terms generally used in those days, late 70s, early 80s. She said, he came to Moose Factory as an elementary teacher, with an open mind and an open heart. He knew how to listen and observe in this new environment he found himself in. Along the west coast of James Bay, Fran was in Attawapiskat. She said his name was associated with teaching excellence, for the simple yet profound reason that he took the time to really get to know and learn from the people, the Mushkegwuk Cree, in whose territory we were all working. John worked hard to put what he learned into practice, spending time on the land, getting to know the people, learning the language and most importantly bringing this understanding into the classroom and his education administration work. His respect for the Cree people and growing knowledge of the history of this area eventually led to his scholarly work, Treaty No. 9, making the agreement to share the land in far northern Ontario in 1905. She continued working in the area of Indigenous education in various parts of Ontario for a number of years. Periodically, I would hear references to John's continued good work in Moose Factory. Some years later, I was fortunate to finally meet Dr. John Long in person when he was a faculty member at Nipissing University and I was Director of Education for Nipissing First Nation. John brought his commitment and dedication to the Cree people of the James Bay area into his work within the Faculty of Education at the university. He was always willing to share his knowledge and understanding with other faculty, staff, administration, Indigenous Council on Education and, perhaps most importantly, with the students he met, Indigenous or non-Indigenous. John supported any students who sought his advice or guidance in a respectful way. He especially advocated for Indigenous students who sought to study or engage in research work of particular interest to them, but perhaps not quite mainstream, i.e. family history and impact of residential school experience, use of the Cree language to defend a graduate thesis. John carried his learning and insights from the James Bay area to his work at Nipissing University. Dr. Long was contracted to do the first-ever school evaluation for the secondary school at Nipissing First Nation. He demonstrated a good understanding of the purpose and importance of our First Nation school, the various challenges inherent and the strengths and accomplishments. His work was done in a very professional and respectful manner, and recommendations were appropriate and realistic with the goal of strengthening Indigenous education. Certainly, all this was to be expected, but not without the insight he brought to the work. She said, John was kind and humble, with a good sense of humor, and at the same time, a very strong, well-versed advocate for Indigenous education. He was, is a giant in my mind in the way he went about his work and indeed, life. He leaves a lasting legacy in the lives he has touched. Dr. Jonathan Pitt is an Indigenous person who teaches Indigenous studies at Nipissing University, and the late Dr. John Long was a friend and colleague of Dr. Pitt's, and an amazing advocate for Indigenous peoples. I asked him about different symbols, like the fence at the former Horden Residential School. Regarding unnatural symbols, these are often represented in the nomenclatures used. For example, in textbooks, we see topics such as Indigenous culture frequently referred to as only existing in the past tense and history, such as residential schooling depicted using black and white photographs. Meanwhile, the last residential school did not close until 1996. The unnatural symbols of residential schools are reminders of the horrors of the government's forced assimilation policy of cultural genocide, he said. As former PM Harper's apology in 2008 echoes now, to kill the Indian in the child, these unnatural symbols of abuse of Indigenous children strip language, culture and identity for generations and their descendants. Many of these unnatural symbols are interconnected with contemporary intergenerational effects. It has been a decade now since the 2015 National Inquiry's Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada released the calls to action for mainstream Canadians, yet minimal work has been done. In an op-ed piece within the Anishinaabeg News, November 11, 2024, Dr. extends his thoughts. On November 3, 2024, Jody Wilson-Raybould and Roshan Dinesh wrote in the Toronto Star that true reconciliation means that there is no place for residential school denialism in Canada, which they also remind us in their new book, Reconciling History, A History of Canada. As Dean Leader George Erasmus noted that a common memory must be created, and needed now more than ever. Denialism as pretending to seek the truth, distorts and diminishes the National Inquiry documents and rejects reconciliation. People. The new off-reserve elementary school, Moose Factory Ministik Island School, was officially opened on September 8, 1984. It was a cool, rainy spring day this year when I walked the fence line. The weather was uncomfortable, but maybe it was meant to be this way. Then I was surrounded by books in the spacious school library, so many adorned with cultural motifs and figures, and I wondered if there were any stories on the book stacks about what I was to hear. I have been invited to visit. I am a teacher, the new school brings happiness. There were survivors or witnesses at the long wooden table of the school, along with intergenerational adults who were affected by what had happened. I am sitting at the end. There was some hesitancy. I am a bit of an interloper. The term is used in a high school short story, The Interlopers by Sake. The story's title itself highlights the central theme of two men, who view each other as intruders on land they both claim ownership of. Appropriate enough for this. Show respect. Indigenous elders have told me. I closed my note-taking book and listened. The stories are poignant, the memories vivid, they reflect upon this. I realized what Lisa and John had tried to do. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada described the residential school system as a cultural genocide. The intergenerational effects of the trauma include lower levels of educational and social attainment, interpersonal violence, and broken relationships between parents and children. Alan Saylors, an elder, attended the school. I asked for his photo next to the fence. He emphatically stated, "We were prisoners, like students in jail." He wants this to be a healing fence. A portion of the fence with landscaping will be retained. It has taken some time to write this, but that day we agreed on the fence, a potential lead to this story. There's a fence in Northern Ontario that has been a symbol of unresolved trauma. The schoolyard is as expensive as a mall parking lot. There could be unmarked graves in the schoolyard or in the nearby cemetery. Time may tell. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission investigated the school, which, like others across Canada, where the highest number of premature deaths among children at these schools was from tuberculosis. On July 9, this summer, there was the Horden Hall gathering. Chief Peter Wesley, Moose Cree First Nation, spoke at the opening of the Horden gathering. He said, "We all have the right to grow up in a safe, nurturing environment with our parents, grandparents, and extended families in our home communities. The federal government took this away from some of us. It created the residential school system that made it mandatory for children to leave their homes and families to attend residential school. As we know, the churches ran the residential schools. A school is supposed to be a safe place of learning, but sadly, the truth is that there are stories of corporal punishment and deaths that took place at the Horden Hall Residential School. The memories are painful for many former students, parents, and grandparents who are no longer with us. The lives of some students ended in school and on the grounds. Fortunately, one comfort measure existed, the bond created between the students. They became brothers and sisters. There are many stories about parents not wanting their children to attend residential school. Some parents hid their children when a government official came around collecting children to take them to a residential school. Parents needed permission to keep their children at home and away from the residential school. The decisions about our loved ones' and ancestors' daily lives were made by people who didn't have their best interests at heart. The trauma inflicted within the Horden Hall Residential School has resulted in intergenerational issues we can all relate to, such as alcohol abuse, drug addiction, child neglect, domestic violence, bullying, mental illness, and difficulty staying connected to our culture and language. He acknowledged the trauma and abuse from those attending the school. Finally, the community here is asking, reaching out. Lindsay Linklater is a member of the Moose Factory Island District School Area Board. She said, "Our vision is to ensure that there is collaboration with our community and stakeholders to support our children to be proud of their identity. We are hoping to have the fence replaced and hope to have communications with the Ministry of Education for conversations on supporting the school community. Asking for a new fence, a community project, to help mitigate the past. To no avail, yet. Maybe this story will help, that's the intent. Maybe there will be a benevolent donor. There is a past and a future for this fence. By myself, the fence speaks to me. My hands are cold, but I hold onto it tightly, my fingers within the mesh openings, white knuckles, trying to feel and yet understand, thinking about the why. In that moment, as I walked away from this very purposeful enclosure, I realized I had journeyed from the outside to the inside. There is much to learn on the back roads.